Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Alex Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who discusses the surprise results of the November 26th Honduran presidential election. Barbara McLean with the group Planning Beyond Capitalism, who proposes the establishment of a women's solidarity network to provide support for victims of sexual harassment. And Wampanoag elder Bert Waters' reading of U.S. political prisoner Leonard Peltier's letter at the annual Day of Mourning Thanksgiving gathering at Plymouth Rock, Massachusetts. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Conservative billionaire Sebastian Piñera won the opening round of Chile's presidential election to replace current President Michelle Bachelet, who was barred from running for another term. In mid-December, Piñera will face off against socialist Alejandro Guillier, who has the support of Bachelet's center-left coalition. When Bachelet steps down, there will be no women presidents in Latin America. Just a few years ago, female leaders governed Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and Costa Rica. Advocates for women leadership in the region hope this is a pause and not a concession to Latin machismo. Bachelet, who served two terms, liberalized strict anti-abortion laws and secured pension bonuses for women who left the workforce to care for their families. Yet, she was unable to reduce violence against women. Still, women have made progress across Latin America since the 1990s. Now, every nation except Guatemala has quotas for female members of local and national legislatures. In the last 20 years, the number of female lawmakers across the region has doubled. In January 1997, Princess Diana walked through an active minefield in war-torn Angola to raise awareness about the threat posed by landmines. 2017 marks the 20th anniversary of the International Landmine Treaty signed by 163 nations. In 2015, over 6,500 people were killed by landmines and cluster munitions. It was double the number of deaths from the previous year, driven mostly by the ongoing war in Syria. But these are far fewer casualties than during the 1990s, when nearly 25,000 people were killed by landmines annually. According to the Christian Science Monitor, over the last 5 years, 370 square miles of minefields were cleared, destroying over 1.3 million anti-personnel landmines. The vast majority of mines cleared were in Afghanistan, Cambodia, and Croatia, heavily agricultural nations. For many poor nations like Angola, landmines held back economic recovery and limited the restoration of agriculture. On the eve of Thanksgiving, federal Judge Lee Eagle overruled Texas Senate Bill 8, which prevented doctors from performing certain second trimester abortions, such as dilation and extraction. Judge Eagle ruled the law placed a burden on women to exercise their reproductive rights, especially since the law required a risky procedure to first stop a fetus's heart. The ruling was a major victory for abortion rights activists and Planned Parenthood. In his opinion, Judge Eagle wrote, "The court concludes requiring a woman to undergo a risky, invasive, and experimental procedure in exchange for exercising her right to choose substantially burdens that right." Immediately after the ruling, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton filed an appeal with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. On several occasions, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled state governments cannot place an undue burden on a woman's access to an abortion before the fetus is viable. Bans similar to the Texas law have been struck down in states, including Alabama, Arkansas, and Oklahoma. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Pollsters and pundits had predicted that the Honduras November 26 presidential election would maintain the status quo, with incumbent conservative president Juan Orlando Hernandez easily winning re-election. But it appears that voters had a different outcome in mind. Opposition candidate Salvador Nasralla, one of the nation's best-known television personalities, was holding a 5-point lead over Hernandez before the nation's Supreme Electoral Tribunal stopped announcing vote totals with 57% of the ballots counted. Both candidates have claimed victory. The tribunal's decision to freeze the public vote count the day after the election generated suspicion that attempts were being made to manipulate the outcome. Nasralla ran as the candidate of the Alliance Against Dictatorship, a coalition formed with the leftist party of former President Manuel Zelaya, who was ousted in a U.S.-supported military coup in 2009. Hernandez, a close ally of Washington, had been widely criticized for engineering the Supreme Court's override of the Honduran Constitution's ban on consecutive presidential terms, widespread corruption, human rights violations, and the assassination of environmental activists, including Goldman Prize winner Berta Cáceres. Your reporter spoke with Alex Main, Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who assesses what may be a surprise outcome of the Honduran election and the danger of another military coup.
Nasralla, he is sort of a figure who's on the center right. It's not very clear. He's not very clearly defined politically because he hasn't really had much of a political career. He first ran for president in 2013. Before that, he'd never held an elected office. And in 2013, he ran on basically an anti-corruption platform. And in fact, the name of his party is the Anti-Corruption Party. He did get, you know, a good amount of votes, especially for a first-time candidate in those elections. And then afterwards, he sort of formed an informal alliance with the Libre Party, which is a left-leaning party that is really sort of an offshoot of the movement of resistance to Honduras's 2009 coup. And some of your listeners may remember that, you know, there was the military coup d'etat against elected president Manuel Zelaya at the time. He was forced out of power at gunpoint, shipped off to Costa Rica. And in the meantime, you had a great deal of repression in Honduras. But also you had a huge movement, massive protests, and a very organized movement that opposed the coup and that wanted to see as well a constituent assembly to sort of, you know, reform what a lot of people saw as a very rotten political system in Honduras. And out of this movement sprung a new political party, which included a lot of members of a traditional party from the left wing of the Liberal Party. And that party was formed in 2011. The head of that party is the deposed president from 2009, President Manuel Zelaya. And so that party is called Libre, or Freedom, and it joined in an alliance with Nasralla's party, the Anti-Corruption Party. You know, few people thought that they would be successful, in part because the private media was sort of universally against them and favorable to the incumbent president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, of the National Party, which is very pro-military, very conservative, and really the biggest beneficiary of the coup politically. And because of Juan Orlando Hernandez's really complete control over the institutions, in particular the courts, and within the court system, the electoral authority, again, the TSE. It was believed that if Nasralla had any chance of winning, fraud would take place. And it does seem that fraud probably has taken place, but that the margin of victory of Nasralla was, you know, so great that, you know, fraud couldn't really make that difference. But now the big question is whether this coalition, which includes this left-wing party and this sort of center-right party, is going to hold together, because they do indeed have different political programs. And it'll be interesting to see If, in fact, Nasrallah does end up being the winner of these elections, and we still have to wait for the TSC to announce the final results, and there's still a possibility of fraud occurring. But if that occurs, what sort of cabinet is he going to have? And what cabinet positions are Libre going to have? What is he going to have? And also, what will be the results of the congressional elections? Because those have taken place as well. The TSC has announced really very few results for the congressional races. And if this coalition doesn't have a majority in Congress, it's going to be very difficult for them to govern.
What is the danger, in your estimation, of another military coup at the hands of the Honduran army? A second part of that question would be, what is the U.S. role here in this election, if any, under the Trump administration, given the history of U.S. backing under the Obama administration for the 2009 coup?
Well, those are two excellent questions, and I think they're very, very linked. And that is because the U.S. provides a lot of training and a lot of equipment and financial support to the Honduran security forces. When you ask whether or not there's a possibility of a military coup, I would say that there is, certainly, especially as the military is very opposed to the Libre Party. With Nasrallah's victory, can potentially be back in power in the government, and the military won't want to see that, and they may act again as they acted in 2009 to prevent that from happening. But there, of course, the U.S. has a tremendous amount of leverage in terms of, you know, their relationship with the Honduran military. It's often said in Honduras that no election result becomes official without the U.S. embassy, you know, basically recognizing the results of the election.
That was Alex Main, Senior Associate for International Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. For more news and analysis of the Honduran presidential election and the human rights conditions in the country, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The explosion of public accusations denouncing perpetrators of sexual harassment over recent weeks has provoked a national dialogue and debate on how society should address the ancient scourge of male sexual aggression and violence. The powerful men named have come from the worlds of movie making, media, business, sports, and politics. While movie producer Harvey Weinstein was the subject of early attention for his long history of predatory behavior, soon other well-known men were named, including actors Kevin Spacey, talk show host Charlie Rose, comedian Louis C.K., Democratic Senator Al Franken, and Michigan Representative John Conyers. However, the well-documented charges of pedophilia leveled against Alabama Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore, who professes to be a fundamentalist Christian, has exposed the selective way in which many political activists accept or reject credible charges of sexual misconduct made against their allies. In this unique moment of collective awakening on sexual harassment, there have been very few concrete proposals on how society could address this age-old epidemic of male sexual coercion and bullying. One exception was a proposal made in an article titled Beyond Harvey Weinstein, What Can Be Done?, written by socialist feminist Barbara McLean, a founder of the group Planning Beyond Capitalism. Your reporter spoke with McLean, who discusses her proposal to form a women's solidarity network that could offer legal and educational assistance to groups of women combating sexual harassment and assault.
I don't want to take credit for this because I read a wonderful article by Jonathan Cook in Dissident Voice. And what, I don't know if you all are familiar with him. If you're not, you should check him out. He's a wonderful journalist. And what he proposed is that, and he was specifically speaking about Hollywood, that they form unions in Hollywood for actresses and actors at any stage of their career, so that particularly these young actresses, the focus right now is on women, so I'm not saying men have not been abused, they have, and it needs to be addressed. But I think, you know, to kind of get a framework, around women, if there was some kind of union organization that could work with women. So when they had complaints, they had a place to go. They could register the complaints. The union could collect those complaints, put them together into a group, and then take some kind of class action, maybe file a class action suit against this individual. I think this is brilliant. I think it's wonderful. But I think it needs to go further. I think, as we're finding out, this is happening not just in Hollywood. It's happening in the Supreme Court, in the White House, in tech. It's happening everywhere, and it's happening in much smaller businesses. So there needs to be something beyond simply a union for women in, say, Hollywood or the arts. So we need to start looking in a larger context. How can we protect all women? And if instead of having a woman's union, we frame it as a women's solidarity network, then this could be something that all women could get behind. And there could be chapters all over the country. My hope would be that groups like, say, Southern Poverty Law Center, other legal aid groups could work with these women to educate them about their rights and, when necessary, to actually file lawsuits on their behalf. So that's kind of like the beginning of where this came from.
In your article, you talk about the explosion of activism that we saw back in 2011 around the Occupy Wall Street movement. And that was almost a spontaneous movement that erupted across the country, in fact, in places all over the world. Do you have any hope that your idea of a woman's solidarity network could take off in a similar way? Or is something like this project a more difficult task that'll take a lot more effort to push, to launch in a way that will be long-lasting?
I'm not sure. One of the things that I've thought about is starting small and simply starting a Facebook group, a Twitter account, to see how many women and men would want to get on board with this. I've watched Black Lives Matter. You know, that was initiated in Oakland, California, where I live, by a very small group of women sitting around after the last police attack on a young black man. And they said, enough, this is enough. And they formed this. There were maybe less than half a dozen of them. And look what's happened to them now. You say Black Lives Matter. Everybody knows what you're talking about. But the fact is, that took off like wildfire. How wonderful if this could take off like wildfire. These types of stratifications, these types of inequalities with women go back before our lifetimes. For generations, it was something that all of us simply accepted and frequently just laughed off and said, well, that's how men are, and that's how it is, and, you know, we just kind of have to put up with it. So my hope is that all of those women who have put hashtag Me Too, sometimes told their stories, sometimes not, that they see that there could be some kind of organization that could help to fight this.
That was Barbara McLean, a socialist feminist and a founder of the group Planning Beyond Capitalism. Find a link to McLean's article Beyond Harvey Weinstein, What Can Be Done, and related material by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Thanksgiving Day this year marked the 48th annual Day of Mourning on Coles Hill, overlooking Plymouth Rock in Plymouth, Massachusetts, where the Pilgrim myth got its start. The gathering is organized by the United American Indians of New England and featured speakers from Labrador to Puerto Rico to Guatemala. Those addressing the gathering paid tribute to American Indian Movement co-founder Dennis Banks, who died on October 29th at age 80. Part of the yearly commemoration includes the reading of a letter from Indigenous political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who's been incarcerated for the past 41 years. He was convicted of killing two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota in 1975, although no evidence links him to the crime, and he's always maintained his innocence. At last year's event, Peltier's letter expressed the hope that President Barack Obama would commute his sentence, especially after the prosecutor in Peltier's case recommended he be freed. However, Obama declined to do so, and there's virtually no chance of a commutation under President Donald Trump. But his short letter, read this year by Wampanoag elder Bert Waters, reflects no bitterness and shows that Peltier's sense of humor and love for the people remain intact. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus was at the Day of Mourning gathering, where she recorded and produced this segment featuring the reading of Peltier's letter.
Statement of Leonard Peltier to National Day of Mourning, Plymouth, Mass., November 2017. Greetings, my friends, relatives, and supporters. Once again, I can't tell you how much I am so honored that you would want to hear my words, or should I say, read my words. You can't imagine the thoughts that go through my head at times, whenever anything or everything is still and quiet in the night, when I lie there staring into the dark with daydreams of how things could possibly be better. I know I've said this once before in some past statement years back. However, it comes to my thoughts how the term Day of Mourning makes me think of a reverse, as in the morning of the new day, and how one term refers to those caught up in a deep sorrow, and how the other term is a promise of a new beginning and the rising of the sun. In our traditions and culture, most tribal nations historically did a mourning period of 1 year for the deceased. However, for us during this point in time, we are continually losing our people, and especially our young people and our women who continually disappear with no trace. Ours lands are constantly violated. The air, the water, the soil, all of nature is screaming against the injustice that is continually perpetrated by those who worship money. So, in essence, I want to say in the loudest voice and in the most sincere voice I can possibly speak, we don't have a day of mourning. We have generations of mourning, year after year. I don't know what I can do further from where I'm at, but in whatever way possible, I want to add my scream to the scream of the earth and the scream of our people for justice. These ecological disasters caused by the wealthy must stop. Those people who are destroying the earth must realize that they ultimately will destroy themselves also. I know many of you have taken part in the prayers and vigils and stood strong in the face of wrongful beatings and shootings and various other forms of violence. And I commend you for your bravery. Having said that, I want to encourage you to move forward to a new day. With each new day, we need to rise to the occasion to defend what is right and to do what we can to right what is wrong. Our enemy is not any person of particular color. Our enemy is those who are ignorant of reality that we are all intricate part of the whole circle, the circle of life. We must arm ourselves with the knowledge it takes to bring attention to the wrongness of their thinking, the wrongness of their exploitation of our Mother Earth, and wrongness of their mistreatment of the indigenous peoples throughout our lands. I would encourage you to mourn, if that is your way, to whatever length of time that is required by your teachings. However, I sincerely encourage each and every one of you to take it upon yourself to become a warrior of one. Educate yourself. Find the knowledge it takes to survive and thrive in a good way, and to confront the ignorance of those who are destroying the natural. Confront them in such a way that they will come to know that to destroy the earth, to destroy our people, to continually ignore the philosophy and teachings that allowed this land to exist since the beginning of time in a beautiful natural existence, they will ultimately destroy themselves and all life. Perhaps I've said too much. I don't know what your agenda is today. Obviously, I have more time than you. I want to say in closing, though, I love you, and I love you wherever you are. I love you, and I love what you want. I love that you want to make a difference, and I will pray for you always. I further want to say, you are making a difference. You have made a difference. Power to the people. Power to the earth.
That was Wampanoag Elder Bert Waters reading Leonard Peltier's annual letter at the Day of Mourning Thanksgiving gathering at Plymouth Rock, Massachusetts. Learn more about the campaign to free Leonard Peltier and Indigenous activist groups by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WXOJ in Northampton, Massachusetts, WDRT in Viroqua, Wisconsin, KSER in Everett, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.